meeting of the House Finance Committee back to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Monday, March 22nd, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative Laban, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wolf, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will be continuing amendments to House Bill 76, extending the COVID-19 disaster emergency. We last heard this bill on Friday. It is the intention to complete amendments and then pass this bill from committee today. There are two amendments remaining. We were discussing a conceptual amendment by Representative Carpenter to Amendment Number 7 by Representative Thompson when we adjourned. We do have Megan Wallace and Andrew Dunmire online from Legal Services for questions. And for clarity of the record, I ask that the motions in progress on Friday be removed and restated. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As Legal Services has drafted a version of my conceptual amendment, I will remove my original conceptual amendment to Amendment 7.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Representative Thompson.
Madam Chair, can I get a clarification what Representative Carpenter had to say there?
He's removed his conceptual amendment. I'm asking that you remove your original motion for Amendment Number 7, and then I'll have you remove that motion. Not remove. To move it again.
Restate.
Yes. So if you could remove your motion for Number 7.
I'll remove it.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, do you have a motion to move Amendment Number 7?
I move that we move Amendment 7.
Is there an objection?
Sure.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I move Amendment 1 to Amendment 7.
Is there an objection?
Sure.
Representative Carpenter.
I don't need to speak any more than we have in the past.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to divide the question. My intention by dividing the question is to hold a separate vote on the portions of the amendment that deletes the powers of the governor. Those portions are found on Amendment 1 to Amendment 7, version B36, from lines 1 through 20. Then vote on the other items in the remainder of the amendment to Amendment 7 as another vote.
Is there objection?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. There was no objection to dividing the question. So our first vote will be amendment number one to amendment number seven, lines 1 through 20. Is there an objection?
Object.
There's been an objection. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ortiz.
Ricketts. Back on the record. We are now voting on amendment number one to amendment number seven. This is lines 1 through 20. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Edgman. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Labonte.
Yes.
Representative Merrick.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
5 yeas, 6 nays.
With a vote of 5 yeas and 6 nays, lines 1 through 20 have not been adopted. Amendment number one to amendment number seven, lines 21 through 23 on page one, and lines 1 through 15 on page 2. Is there an objection?
Object.
Will the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Rasmussen.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Wool.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Josephson. Representative Labonte.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Merrick.
No.
1 yea, 10 nays.
And with a vote of 1 yea and 10 nays, lines 21 through 23 on page 1 and lines 1 through 15 on page 2 have not been adopted. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're back to the original HB 76, correct?
Yes, amendment number seven.
Okay, we did go through and explain what HB 76 by itself had, what it would accomplish. We also have online, I think, Adam, Commissioner of Social, Health and Social Services, Commissioner Adam Crum online, and we have Suzanne Cunningham, the Health and Social Services Legislative Liaison, and I'd like to hear from both of them on what this, what the administration thinks about this HB 76 and what it does to health and social services.
For clarification, Representative Thompson, what Amendment 7 does?
Yes.
Amendment Thank you.
7 in its original form.
Commissioner Crum.
Thank you, Chairman Merrick. For Amendment 7 to HB 76, Representative Thompson's amendment, this still supports the governor's position that a disaster declaration is not needed, nor the broad authorities contained within the Alaska Disaster Act. So this provides the limited authorities for the state to continue essential response elements. So the state is supportive, or the administration is supportive of Amendment 7.
Thank you. Is there someone else you would like to testify?
Is Suzanne Cunningham online?
Ms. Cunningham?
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, legislative liaison for the Department of Health and Social Services. I don't have any further comment outside of what Commissioner Crum has made, but the amendment does meet the request of the governor to outline certain authorities to support the continued response to COVID-19 in Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, what HB 76 does is it deletes the language that, the declaration of emergency.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not sure if the question is more appropriate for Ms. Cunningham or Commissioner Crum, but I did see today that the Senate leadership had announced a condensed version of Senate Bill 56, which I believe is the companion bill to 76. And I was just curious if you could highlight Amendment Number 7, how similar the language is to what may be coming out of the Senate pretty soon.
Ms. Cunningham?
Thank you for the chair. Through the chair, this is Suzanne Cunningham, Department of Health and Social Services. Representative Rasmussen, I have not reviewed the language or a committee substitute for Senate Bill 56 yet, but when we are able to receive that draft and look at it, we'll be able to provide a response in writing to you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As to the Amendment 7, which is before us, I don't support it, and I would note that already the bill before us pares back much of what was done in late March. It no longer speaks to medical officer standing orders. It no longer speaks to elections by mail or forbearance of state loans or workers' comp presumption or liability. I guess it does concern liability for PPE under the Lebon Amendment. It doesn't discuss RCA deadlines, sanitation for retail sellers, moratorium on disconnection of residential utilities, moratorium on evictions or foreclosures, moratorium on repossession of motor vehicles, permanent fund absences, income determination, seafood distribution, and finally, the homelessness assistance and the Office of Administrative Hearings flexibility. So this is already really pared down. And I guess I would cite again to something the Director of Public Health said in response to Representative Ortiz's question, does this bill provide what you need? She said, yes. The bill before us, without Amendment 7, provides what they need. And I'm going to take her to her word. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Thompson.
Noted that the governor's letter of March 18th to Speaker Stutz, a disaster declaration is no longer needed, but we need legislation to support the state's response to continue the state's public health response. However, limited authority to support the state's response are needed. Limited authority is needed, and these are addressed in this amendment that I offered up today. But again, none of those items need a disaster declaration to accomplish the state's response.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Josephson, is your objection maintained?
It wasn't mine, but I do object.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, the objection is maintained. On Amendment Number 7, will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wool.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Edgman.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Lebon.
Yes.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen?
Yes.
Representative Merrick?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
4 yeas, 7 nays.
And a vote of 4 yeas to 7 nays, amendment number 7 has failed to be adopted. Amendment number 1 was rolled to the bottom of the list. Megan Wallace is online from Legislative Legal to speak to the legal opinion we received last week from Representative Carpenter. Amendment number 1 by Representative Josephson, is there a motion?
I move amendment number 1.
Object.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, fundamentally, this is a very straightforward and simple amendment. It says that the legislature blesses and decrees that the extensions, 3 of them, November 15, December 15, January 15, of the emergency declaration as spelled out in HB 241 last year, are ratified, fully ratified. The legal memo, mostly, I've read a lot of memos, and sometimes they express more uncertainty or misgivings. This one really doesn't. Yes, it says that there can be exceptions to the rule, but in repeated instances, it says it's okay, broadly speaking, to retroactively ratify those. Yesterday, on the floor of our body, I take it back, Saturday, we ratified earlier, effectively Zoom hearings that were held remotely by nonprofits and corporations. We said that those were in effect, Madam Co-Chair, we said that those were in effect dating back to March the 11th. So we went back in time and blessed an entire year of board and nonprofit meetings. The vote, incidentally, on that was unanimous. There were some excused people in both bodies. No one voted against it. I'm simply saying, let's do that again as to the emergency declarations. This does 2 really important things, and then I'll stand down on this. The first thing it does is it says we, according to our lawyers, in a simple reading of the language, we alone can extend a declaration. The governor can't do it. And so 10 years from now, 20, 30 years from now, when a governor has to issue a disaster declaration and his chief of staff says, you know, you can just extend them yourselves because in 2020, Governor Dunleavy did that. The chief of staff will have to say, yeah, but really the legislature okayed it. And so this body that we should, by definition, have some protective instinct over would be reasserting itself and saying, really, that's our domain. That's important. The second thing is, if I were the governor and the chief of staff, I'd say, wow, this is a real friendly amendment because we simply can't be successfully sued for extending the declaration. The legislature has ratified that. They've covered this issue. Everyone is covered politically. Everyone is covered substantively. And it's for that reason I offer the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen, would you like to speak to your objection? Ms. Wallace, if you could give us a brief explanation of the memo that we were provided by Representative Carpenter last week, and we would also have a request that you can give a detailed description of Section 3, which deals with the financing of this bill. Ms. Wallace?
For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. With respect to the memo that was provided to the committee regarding extension of a disaster and whether or not the retroactivity provision that's currently contained in the bill would cause a legal issue, given that the state is no longer under an active disaster declaration, the memo before the committee generally goes through the considerations to take into, or that the legislature should consider when inserting a retroactivity provision into legislation. And retroactivity provisions are not uncommon legislative tools, and from from a legal perspective, it has the effect that to go backwards in time, meaning that there's no break from a legal perspective with respect to a law that's made to have retroactive effect. One of the most common areas of concern for a retroactivity provision would be for the legislature to make sure that it's not creating a penalty or other penal punishment for conduct that wasn't unlawful at the time a person acted or did not act a certain way. And so retroactive criminal provisions, for example, generally are not permitted except in rare circumstances. So the memorandum before you generally outlines, and it inserts language from our Manual of Legislative Drafting outlining best practices with respect to retroactivity provisions, but as the opinion notes, it's my opinion that the retroactivity provision that currently is in HB 76 would likely survive challenge if it were challenged, but as the opinion notes, that this would be an issue of first impression, so there's always some risk that someone could make, you know, other arguments if they wanted to mount a challenge to this provision.
Thank you. I'd like to note that we've been joined by Representative Kronk. Ms. Wallace, can you comment on Section 3, the financing plan?
Yes, through the chair, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. I'm generally familiar with the financing plan. We have Andrew Dunmeyer from my office who's online and has been the attorney that has been specifically involved with respect to drafting of HB 76 and the provisions in front of you. But as a matter of explanation and looking backwards, so Alaska Statute 2623.020, which is part of the Disaster Act, specifically provides certain limitations of what the governor can spend with respect to a disaster without legislative approval. And Section 3, the financing plan before you, is the legislature approving a financing plan so that and setting out expectations of the sources of funds that the governor would utilize in responding to a disaster. And there are some provisions in the Alaska Disaster Act that allow the governor to expend from the Disaster Relief Fund in an effort to respond to the disaster, but this provision more narrowly defines what is approved for financing and what is approved for expenditure with respect to the COVID disaster that is contemplated in HB 76.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace. Is there further discussion on Amendment 1? Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask the administration online if they have an opinion regarding this amendment.
Commissioner Crum?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, thank you. I apologize. Didn't know if I was on mute. So for the record, this is Commissioner Crum. The administration has no opinion on this, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would rather hold my comments till the bill itself and not the amendment.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 1? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen.
I maintain my objection.
Oh, I agree. Thank you.
Okay. With that, will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wool.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Edgman. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Laban?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen?
No.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Merrick?
Yes.
6 yeas, 5 nays.
And with a vote of 6 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 1 has been adopted. With that, we have finished amendments on House Bill 76. That takes us to the bill itself. Is there discussion? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, co-chair. I appreciate the comments from Representative earlier regarding the legislature caring or should care about its responsibility in regards to disaster declarations. I can't help but acknowledge that the action that we're taking today with retroactivity is doing something that the legislature, the statute, the Constitution was not intended to do. We have before us a governor who has very clearly indicated that he does not wish to have an emergency declaration. And we are going to use retroactivity to force one on him. And I think that is a mistake. It is a bad precedent to set. It is not necessary, as we've heard laid out by members of his administration, to address the COVID crisis. And such, this is a bad idea. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comments of the previous speaker on this particular issue. However, I would just take a slight exception with the comment that the governor has very clearly expressed his desire not to have an emergency declaration, because it was just a little over, maybe less than a month ago, that the governor was the one who submitted HB 76 as a governor's bill, which was an extension of the emergency declaration. So whatever transpired between a month ago and today, which has caused him to say that he doesn't need an emergency declaration, I don't know. I haven't heard. What is the explanation for that? But it was the very clear, it was the governor's bill that originated HB 76, which was an extension of the emergency declaration.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think that if our goal is to pass a piece of legislation quickly to the other body and then to the executive branch that gives the limited powers that the administration has expressed as tools for navigating through the end of the pandemic, that our best option hopefully will still be considered on the full floor with Amendment Number 7. But I think that the public has expressed strong concern against another disaster declaration. The administration has requested specific limited powers that allow to navigate out of the economic crisis that has followed so many business closures from the pandemic. It allows for the vaccine allocation to those who wish to vaccinate, and as well suspends regulations that are needed for some telehealth and airport testing, which I believe the airport testing has been very successful in the number of cases that have been caught. And as we gear up for the summer and hopefully bring as many tourists up to the state as possible, I think it's important that we have measures in place to protect Alaskans, especially in smaller communities who may not have access to the same medical facilities as we have in larger cities here. But our cases have drastically declined. Our state needs to get businesses back open and give confidence in Alaskans as we go back to what life looks like as normal. And I don't think it's appropriate for us to continue to reference a bill that we passed in March of last year prior to the height of the pandemic. We didn't know what powers the governor would need to protect Alaskans at that time and what tools the state would need to handle what we could possibly be facing. So I appreciate that the bill before us has more limited tools, but I still think that it goes a little bit too far. And I hope that we'll consider which battles are the most important for us to fight, because we're fighting to give tools to the administration that they are not asking for. And I know that we have a lot of work before us as the Finance Committee with a budget and some serious fiscal challenges. So it's my sincerest hope that we will not dwell too long on this issue and move past it to get to the serious work of the state.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. We have Representative Josephson, Wool, Thompson, and Edgemond. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To use a baseball metaphor, I have real confidence that if we haven't yet rounded third, we're about to make that cut that a base runner does on his way home. But you don't get the run until you touch plate. And we've lost 544,000 people. And I know there's folks that worry that we've over-embellished or exaggerated this, that is the equivalent nearly, not quite, of the losses from the American Civil War over 4 years. I would say if the administration doesn't want these powers, they have lots and lots of discretion to not use them, but they should be afforded them. They help provide local government guidance. And even though I myself have said, boy, you know, I've had the vaccine. I can say that now publicly without much begrudgment, because most others have. And Alaska has done well. But the variants are there. And I'm not a doomsdayer, but they're a concern. We saw just last week our colleagues in Boise, Idaho, they left the Capitol because they couldn't contain COVID. Last week that happened. So I don't think it's unreasonable to pass this very, very pared down version of the emergency declaration to the other body, well, to the floor and hopefully to the other body. And I'd also note there are 17 states with rising cases. We don't want that to happen here. We've done well. We need to keep doing well. And that's why I support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I support very much what the previous speaker just said. I had a different number, 13 states, maybe 17 states, are seeing increases right now, spiking. And a lot of these states have a high vaccine rate, which means even though they're vaccinating a lot of people, it's increasing. There's variants out there. They're twice as deadly, 56% more contagious. So it's not over. And why not give more tools that a declaration will give us? When there's a major flood or a tornado or a hurricane that rushes through a state, they immediately declare a disaster declaration because they get a lot of federal funding and FEMA help and all these kinds of things. So it's better to have these options. If we want to get cruise ships back, if we want to get tourists back, if we want to make Alaska continue to be one of the safest states in the country, I think we should do the things that are at our disposal. And having a disaster declaration gives us those things. You don't have to do it. And many of the things that people cited aren't happening and didn't happen have nothing to do with the disaster declaration. But I support the declaration. I know the administration did a month ago. And why they're walking that back, I'm not sure, but I say let's better to be on the preventative side. I want businesses, I want the economy to move forward, and I don't want to do anything that would impede that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Permission to read?
Permission.
This is a letter from Governor Dunleavy, dated March 18th. My administration conducted a thorough analysis to determine what essential tools were necessary to continue the state's public health response. We concluded we needed limited authority to support four elements of the state response. And he listed four items. And he continued, though the above items need legislation, none need a disaster declaration, nor the broad authorities contained within the Alaska Disaster Act to occur. Despite having made it clear that the state does not need a disaster declaration, the House House Health and Social Services Committee chose to move the bill HB 76 forward with a full disaster declaration included. In response to the prior speaker, we all want to see our businesses open up and get back to work, but a full disaster declaration will give the governor authority to cut back on all of that. He could hurt this in the future by shutting down businesses, shutting down travel, and that's all allowed in HB 76, and I am not in support of HB 76 in its form at the present time.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Well, I have a lot more faith in the administration than the previous speaker. By providing a disaster declaration, all we simply are doing is giving the governor the option to put it in a motion. And when you look at where we're at, as of information from late last week, there was 27 known cases of variants in the United States. And guess what? 5 of them were in Alaska. When you look at where we're at in terms of vaccination in Alaska, I think we're still at about the quarter level in terms of Alaskans being fully vaccinated. We also know that a lot of Alaskans, and it's clearly their own choice, will choose not to get vaccinated. And so for a number of reasons, we clearly are not out of the woods at all. It's a real interesting sort of dividing line, if you will, because this issue of a disaster declaration, unfortunately, in Alaska has gotten highly politicized as well as across the country. We heard in front of this committee, I thought, a very clear sort of demarcation line between those who viewed this as giving the governor absolute sort of shutdown powers to infringe upon personal liberties, to put into place restrictions that would cause harm to the economy, and mask mandates, to hunker down, sort of all the things that we collectively are highly fatigued having to endure as we get through the pandemic, which I would agree there is indeed light at the end of the tunnel, but we're not quite there yet. So I argue, why wouldn't we join the Alaska Public Health Association, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association, Alaska State Chamber, the Alaska Municipal League, Alaska Primary Care Association, the Alaska Children's Trust, Alaska Food Coalition, who vigorously asked us to keep the disaster declaration in place. In my view, to not give the governor this authority is to be short-sighted. It's to shirk my fiduciary duty as a policymaker and to look at data objectively. And I ask not only what's the downside, but what happens if things in Alaska take a turn for the worst and we're out of session? What will the governor do then? Unilaterally put a disaster declaration into place? What's the plan if things go south, if the variants take hold in Alaska and the governor doesn't have the authority to, God forbid, and nobody wants him to do it, but have to put public health mandates back into place, not public health advisories in the absence of a disaster declaration, but health mandates. So as a legislator, I have to look into the future, and I have to weigh all the information in front of me and make the best decision that I possibly can make. And I have a district that, by and large, supports having every protective measure in place. And do I have some people that are going to push back? I do. Of course I do. But I'll sit down with them and explain to them, look, we're just giving the governor a tool. He doesn't have to lift a finger. He doesn't have to put his pen to paper. He doesn't have to do anything with a disaster declaration. But it's there if he needs it. You know, I think of my neighbor down the street in Dillingham, who keeps his snowplow on from September till May. Do I tell him, you should take your snowplow off because, you know what, it's spring in Alaska. There's no more snow. Oh, don't worry about it, you know. Or when I get in a car, do I not put my seatbelt on because I'm not going to crash? Of course I put my seatbelt on. It's a law, but it's also because I'm thinking along the lines of protection and indemnification and what could happen, what hopefully doesn't happen, but what may happen, you know. And I think back to a Zoom call that I was on last week with Dr. Zink and the state epidemiologist and others. where, you know, our chief medical officer said there is still widespread community transmission in Alaska. It's not where it was before. And thank goodness our death rates are down, our ICU units are in better shape. But, you know, there are strains of this variant that we just don't know even definitively how the vaccines are going to work against them. You know, we're optimistic and we're cautiously guarded about the future. But I think there's the need to put this tool into place. I know there's differences on this committee. I respect that. But, Madam Co-Chair, I'm going to support, and strongly so, the need to put a disaster declaration into place. And hopefully we don't have to use it. The governor doesn't have to engage in any sort of health mandates that would restrict not only individual liberties, but also what might happen on a broader scale in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suspect this bill will pass out of House Finance and be delivered for debate, for further debate. And depending upon what the Senate does on their concurrent resolution or their concurrent bill, Senate Bill 56, there'll be a grand bargain negotiated, and then something will be delivered to the governor for his endorsement and signing it into law. So ultimately, this is up to the administration as to whether they accept this authority or not. I'm pleased that we did amend this bill to offer private sector business liability protection, because I felt that was important and it should have been in there. So I thank the committee for support on that. However, I do wish that we had adopted Representative Thompson's amendment. That would have aligned with the administration. That amendment originated with help from the administration. So our failure to adopt that amendment, I think, creates a little bit of a problem with this. But with that comment, Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to thank the previous speaker, Representative LeBron, for introducing the amendment that helps protect small businesses. As a former small business owner, I truly appreciate that, and I'll be glad to support this bill with that provision in it. As was mentioned earlier, the Alaska Chamber supports this bill with the emergency declaration, and I got a letter in my email today that Fedco, the Fairbanks Economic Development Corp., also supports it. So as far as being worried about how it affects businesses, that's two major business groups, one statewide, one regional, that supports this bill in its current form with the amendment as well. So I do think this is a pro-business bill, and I think it does provide tools, you know, and I hate to keep using, you know, tool in the toolbox, but it definitely provides that. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm going to go ahead and just relate a, if you will indulge me, a joke that I heard last week, and this is no joking matter, but it has to do with fishing, since we were talking about sports analogies. And since one guy was always coming back with a fish and no one else seemed to be able to catch anything, one day the Fish and Game said, could I come along? See, what are you doing exactly that's a little bit different? So they went out to do a little fishing, and the guy pulls out a stick of dynamite, and he throws it in the water, and boom, here comes up all these fish, and he's got all these fish in his hand. And the warden says, wait, whoa, wait, you can't do that. And the guy hands him a stick of dynamite, and he says, are you going to talk or are you going to fish? And so that was a joke. What I'm trying to say is sometimes you hand people a tool to do something, they don't always want to have that handed to them. And I think because we need, the governor has said that he does not want this declaration, because I feel like we need a program to keep up with whose bill it is. It's a governor's bill, but it was introduced to by someone else, then other representatives, then we have the governor saying, yes, we want it, but we want this in it, and so on, but not the bill that we have before us. And while I appreciate the amendment that does provide a liability, and I appreciate that amendment. I do think it keeps small business owners in a state of uncertainty. So with that, Madam Chair, I will be a no vote.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And then I guess I'll take one last final bite at the apple here as we move on. Trust was brought up earlier, trust in the governor. And I think that the sequencing of events is important for us to keep in mind. I think the statute, as it's written, is important to keep in mind. If we were looking at a disaster declaration that was currently in effect, the statute and the timing of when that disaster declaration would be was declared would matter, because the statute specifically says the legislature is the only one that can extend it past 30 days, and it's a travesty that we were not able to deal with that previously when the other emergency declarations were declared. The legislature should have had a role in that. The timing is such that the governor has changed his mind, conditions have changed, and he says in his letter that he's no longer interested in having an emergency declaration. And we can't trust him at his word that his perspective, per the statute, is that we don't need an emergency declaration. He can accomplish everything he needs to respond without an emergency declaration. That wasn't the same thing that he was saying in January or February, but that is what he's saying now. And per the statute says that we have the right to extend an emergency declaration that's currently in effect. Well, there are no emergency declarations that are in effect right now. And we don't have a governor who's requesting one. And yet we are bent on giving him one. And yes, we have said, I've heard through the organization here, and I think in spoken comments, that politics are being played. I completely agree. We have a governor that does not want an emergency declaration as of today, and we are going to give him one. I think that is a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have a brief fatties. Back on the record, we have Sabrina Javier from Legislative Finance online to review the fiscal notes. Ms. Javier?
Hi, this is Sabrina Javier with Legislative Finance. For the record, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I believe there are five fiscal notes for this bill, HB 76, in front of you guys.
Come
committee.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, legislative finance for most of these fiscal notes, legislative finance sees no technical issues with these fiscal notes. However, the one fiscal note I will note for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for the Office of the Commissioner allocation, we did ask, because it was an indeterminate fiscal note due to the unknown need for the state active duty deployment. And I believe the Guard can be deployed for a federal disaster without a state disaster being declared. So when there, we did ask the department if there would be a fiscal impact of deploying the state defense force without a state disaster being active. And emergency management responded to that, saying that if a public health disaster emergency is not extended, the only state active duty that would be used for the COVID-related items, that would be contact tracing, vaccine distributions, et cetera. This is possible because they are still under the federal declaration, also known as DR-4533, and the state declaration, AK-269.
Thank you. Are there questions regarding the fiscal notes? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Javier, for your help. Is there further discussion on HB 76? Representative Thompson.
I did want to make, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to make a clarification of a comment made earlier. Both SB 56 and HB 76 were penned by the administration around mid-January. We weren't in session, so we couldn't get ours introduced, but SB 56 did get introduced back then. And I just wanted to point out that that's over 2 months ago. And since then, the governor has reevaluated where we're at and what he needs. And so I really think that we should not move forward with HB 76 because it's not necessary, and I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, I would like to make sure it's imperative that Alaskans understand that HB 76 does not implement any mandates. No mask mandates, no occupancy restrictions, no business or school closures, and it certainly does not impose mandatory vaccinations. With that, do we have a motion?
Madam Chair?
Co-chair.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 76, version 32-GH1011/B, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes, and also allow to allow legislative legal to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection?
Objection.
Will the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Laban.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Wool.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Merrick.
Yes.
6 yeas, 5 nays.
And with a vote of 6 yeas and 5 nays, House Bill 76 as amended is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. We will take a brief at ease.
department, but just...
Okay. House Finance, back to order. Coming back from at ease. And Mr. Rob Carpenter, are you online?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Oh, great. Let's see. If you don't mind, turning your... Oh, great. We just want to see your mug there. We're going to hear a presentation on the Alaska Marine Highway System from the Department of Transportation. Presenting will be Deputy Commissioner Rob Carpenter, Marine Transportation Services Manager Matt McLaren, and Division Director John Falvey. They're all online. So with that, Deputy Commissioner, if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record and go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And we have Matt McLaren, the Business Manager, and Captain John Falvey, our General Manager of the Marine Highway System, with me today. And we're going to have a brief presentation for you with a lot of numbers because this is the Finance Committee and we love numbers. So if no further comments or questions, I'll proceed.
Okay.
Moving on to slide two, I just wanted to highlight some of the challenges we're facing. As you all are aware, I just real briefly, we have an exceptionally aging fleet of vessels, which are immensely challenging to operate and very expensive. We also deal with turnover and recruitment issues, especially in regards to our declining budget and the uncertainty of our budget. It's been challenging to keep employees, to recruit employees and to retain them year round. And we'll address that point later with a scenario that has been provided. Budgetarily speaking, some of the other challenges are, of course, relating back to aging vessels, our system reliability and our vessel flexibility. As you all are familiar with the Reshaping Work Group report that came out from the governor's Reshaping Work Group, that system reliability and dependability was probably the most underlying theme there. And that has a lot to do with not only our aging fleet, but also the budgetary impacts. And then our vessel flexibility, of course. You know, we have a couple new ships that the Alaska-class ferries or Alaska-class vessels, if you will, that are limited in what they can do, and, you know, doesn't provide the redundancy and reliability that we need for the system. So we're certainly examining ways to improve that. And then, of course, our collective bargaining agreements are complex. They're very detailed. And they provide some management challenges, quite a few, and we can expand on that if you'd like. But and as you're all aware, COVID-19 has been a problem for everyone. We've had actually quite a bit of success this past year, knock on wood, after an initial experience with the Tustamina. We implemented a mitigation plan that has worked quite well. And but again, that brings us to Prince Rupert, which Canadian border closure has prevented us from working out what we needed to do there to return to Prince Rupert, and we're still working with that at this time. Happy to take any questions there. I can move forward, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask about the collective bargaining agreements. Is that from you, Rod?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, yes, happy to answer any questions.
A few years ago, we were trying to figure out how to slow down the losses, through the chair, the losses suffered by the Marine Highway System, and they had closed the bars on the ferries, and I had questions about that because the Alaska Brewing Company here in Juneau said they rolled hundreds of kegs of beer on and off of the ferries, and any set of businesses that went through that much beer would have to have profit. I asked the question back then was, why aren't we then taking the tourist seasons of the year through the summer and sending that and leasing out the bar operations for profit to a local or individual business. And I was told that the bargaining agreement would not let vendors come onto the ships, including the bars and the gift shops. So after digging deeper into it, we found the PCNs for the bartenders, and they were being paid $110,000 a year. So I was wondering if that has been changed any, or is that still the, if there is a bar, I mean, or if the same with the gift shops, or have that, has that been changed?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the bars are all closed on the vessels. Since they did close a few years ago, I think your memory's accurate on the cost of the bartenders. I might have Captain Falvey expand on that comment a little bit, if he could, on the history of the bars, et cetera.
Yes, for the record, Captain John Falvey, General Manager of Oskamy Highway System, through the chair, Representative Thompson, the bars and the gift shops remain closed. You know, and your memory is correct. Those positions, you know, to staff those facilities, shipboard were very costly. Matt McLaren, our business manager, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but we were I believe losing well over $1 million a year on bars and gift shops. It was about 1.2. And that has not changed. We do on some of the ships serve beer and wine. We still have a liquor license for that, but not all the ships. So, but it has things have not changed. The bargaining agreements have not changed in that the state would have relief as far as being able to outsource those to the bars and the gift shops. We have not gotten to that point.
Follow up.
Thank you, to the chair. If I remember correctly, I think at that time they told us that the bars were losing $500,000 a year. And as far as outsourcing, that's still not been straightened out in the contract. I mean, it's still in effect.
Captain Falvey, through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's correct. That is not that has not been changed in the collective bargaining agreements yet.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, back then we tried to track those PCNs of the bartenders, and the union contract did not allow for them to be laid off, and they all continued to work on shore duties. I just wanted to point that out, just what we were told back then. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm trying to remember the group. I did meet with one of the unions in 2019, and they had mentioned that there could be cost savings if the state would work with them on, I believe, giving them the ability to handle scheduling or something. There was some element that would have ended up costing the state or saving the state money, and I was curious if any of those conversations had happened in the last 2 years between the state and the union.
Captain Falvey, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, and I believe, Representative, you may be discussing dispatching of our unlicensed IBU and MMP and MEBA staff. We have not, we have not entertained that. It's a very, very complex evolution. It's a situation where, with these complex contracts, we need to be very careful how we dispatch people, to be very careful of payment, travel, things like that. We do have vacation committees that meet to pre-discuss in certain packages of time when employees on the ships, come and go. We do that, for the officers and for the unlicensed. So we do feel that helps alleviate some of the challenges of dispatching the crews.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you speak to what happens with the employees when a ship or a vessel breaks down or needs repair and the employees are stranded wherever the vessel is for days or weeks?
Through the chair, Captain Falvey again, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. Well, if a ship breaks down, the employees, in essence, stay with the ship. Or we rotate them per, you know, when it's time for them to rotate out, we at times have to do flying crew changes. We will actually fly the new crew in as opposed to the crew joining in the port that it would normally change in. You know, we're changing these crews every 2 weeks now because of COVID. Prior to that, prior to agreements that we've had with the unions, most all of the crew were changing on a weekly basis, and that's every 2 weeks to reduce COVID exposure as far as crew coming and going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my other question about the aging vessels then is, what does the Marine Highway System do when a ship or a vessel goes down and leaves the passengers stranded for days or weeks? Is there any system in place to make sure that people get home, or how does that work? Because I've heard concern about the reliability of the vessels, and I think it's going to be an increasing problem if people end up being stranded. They may not trust the reliability of the Marine Highway at a certain point.
Kevin Falvey, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. We do our very best to work with the passengers that may be on a stranded, broke-down, vessel. Years prior, when we had more ships running, we had a lot more flexibility to reroute another ship that was running up through the system. With our present scheme of six ships now, and even potentially less in the summer, it tends to limit us, depending upon how severe the breakdown is. And I will just use a recent one where the Matanuska broke down, and we had folks, that were stranded, per se, trying to get to Sitka. We refunded monies, and that would then allow them to fly and barge the vehicles, and we provide guidance as to how to do that, how to get a hold of the barge lines, what the schedules are, what the flight schedules are, and we do our very best to, try to guide them and help them get alternate transportation. In the case of the recent Matanuska breakdown, we had the ship repaired in a timely enough fashion within a few days to bring the rest of the folks up North Lynn Canal to Haines and Skagway. But it's a case-by-case situation. We do work very closely with them to try to help them, and in some cases refund them if they're really stuck and there's no other way to get the way they get, and the refunds help them get alternate transportation.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Could you guess how often one of the vessels goes down? And in maybe calendar year, how many times would you say a vessel has major repair needed and has to extend the amount of time that they may be in a given location?
Kevin Falvey, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. And I really don't think it's as much as we might think. You might have for a mainline ship that's running, let's say, for example, over 12 months, aside from its, 8-week overhaul period in the shipyard, maybe once or twice a year, and it's usually not a very lengthy breakdown. The ships are, fairly reliable, but they do break down. They're old, and we do the best we can to keep them running. But it's, it's a random number. Some years are better than others.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz and then LeBron. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Falvey, going back to the topic of union contracts and talks, negotiations, call them what you will, between management and unions. based on the conversation so far, it would be my interpretation and probably everybody else's interpretation on this committee that there's been very little willingness on the part of unions to make concessions when requests are made for contracting out. But I have a document in front of me that says something to the contrary, that over the years, over the last 10 years, there's been numerous occasions where unions, the negotiating groups that are used on the Alaska Marine Highway System have made accommodations when contracting out requests have been made. So is that true, or have they shown no willingness to cooperate and to make adjustments when management make requests?
Kevin Thalby through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Just a question. Are we talking about outsourcing routes, or are we talking about negotiating collective bargaining agreements? I'm not quite sure about the question.
Well, I guess I would say both. You know, I think any time where the state approaches the bargaining groups for whatever types of concessions that they're looking for, has there been a willingness on the part of the unions to talk and to make concessions?
Kevin Thalby through the chair, Representative Ortiz. I would say in general, yes. You know, we do have an outsourcing contract agreement for the villages out of either Juneau or Sitka. In the past, the unions, if we got into a situation where we needed to provide some extra service, they have, you know, agreed to, over a short period of time, outsource North Lynn Canal to Haines and Skagway. I think just in general, as we negotiate with them, and we do have a contract with the IBU, the unlicensed union. We've had that for about a year now. There's a lot of give and take when we sit down to negotiate. The way we normally do that is management will, set out, a series of, wish list, and then it's a bargaining. That's what bargaining is. It's back and forth, and they usually work things out. We're in the process now of bargaining with the licensed unions, MMP and the IBU. So I would say yes in general. You know, we usually, get to the bottom of things and get agreements.
Thank you for that. And just as a quick follow-up on the specific issue, the topic of gift shop management, contracting out for that came up in the discussion. For a person to have gotten in the position to be a gift shop manager, they don't like start in that. They are part of the general IBU crew, I would imagine, and through the process they earn the usual wages that everybody on the crew earns, but then things move forward and now their duties include gift shop management. But any wages that they're getting are not a result of them being specifically gift shop managers. It's a result of them being a part of the IBU and going through the process and moving up and gaining wage increases for experience, et cetera. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Kevin Thalby, Representative Ortiz. Yeah, in general, that's correct. There's different categories of wage, descriptions and what they're paid, of course, fully burdened. In the case of the gift shops and the bars, all of those, IBU staff, because it would involve the IBU, the unlicensed, were placed into other positions shipboard. So there was no loss of employment over the shutting of the gift shops. We moved those shipboard staff into other positions. As far as the actual fully burdened wages, what exactly that is, Matt McLaren could probably provide a lot more background if you'd like on that.
Representative Ortiz.
And then the final quick follow-up then on the issue of the bar manager being paid, quote, $110,000 a year. Again, he may or may not have been paid that much amount of money, but the, or she, I should say. But the issue is not that specific job per se. It's the fact that they've been part of an organization which caused them to rise to that level of pay, whether they were the bar manager or whether they were continuing to load cars on the ferry. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that number is, of course, a fully, you know, fully burdened with benefits number, whatever that number might be. It isn't just wages.
Thank you very much.
In the queue, I've got Representative LeBon, then Representative Regman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on the same line of discussion, I hear that, number one, no gift shop employee or bar employee was laid off. And number two, thinking back, last time I rode on the ferry system was in 2017, and the bar wasn't open then, so I'm guessing it's been at least that long. So my next question would be, under the challenges of the collective bargaining agreements, there's a number of collective bargaining agreements, and I would suspect one of the agreements must cover the bar and gift shop. So is there another opportunity to renegotiate the status of the bar and gift shop, and is that coming up soon?
Kevin Felvey through the chair, and I'm sorry, but I missed the representative's name. Well, that may be something that we would have to go back and discuss, maybe a potential letter of an agreement, because we are 1 year into the current contract with the Inland Boatman's Union, and we're probably about a year away from beginning to talk again, because these are 3-year contracts. So the only way around that would be to try to discuss some sort of a letter of agreement with them to allow that, aside from the contract, an outsourcing of bars and gift shops.
Follow-up. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really didn't expect to get a very exact answer, because it wasn't a fair question, but I had to ask it anyway. So I will just share, if I may, Mr. Chairman, a quick private sector story. I financed a hotel, bar, and restaurant business years ago in my banking days, and I was asking the owner about different parts of his business and how they were doing and where he's making his money, and I asked about his restaurant. And I said, so how is operating the restaurant working for you? He says, well, I don't operate the restaurant. I lease the space, and another private business operates the restaurant. I said, oh, is your take a percentage of the sales? He says, no. I lease the restaurant space to the operator for $1 a month. I said, well, you're probably not making a killing on that. He says, oh, quite the contrary, I am. The agreement I have with the restaurant operator is that he provides the best service, the best food, and does so consistently every month, or our lease arrangement is over. And my customers, the folks that are running the room where I really make my money, and the bar where they drink and I really make my money, they're happy because they get good meals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Are pretty hard comments to follow. So just real quickly, looking at the challenges, I count seven of them up there, and the bottom two, at least in my view, may be more accurately characterized as sort of situational, short-term challenges, if you will. Maybe that's true or not so true. But the top five are definitely systemic challenges that have been around for a long time, but it almost seems to me, and maybe if I can get some quick input, that we're missing one there. And the one that we're missing is a lack of a collective vision on how to sort of transition, a marine highway system that is, you know, provides critical services to a large part of the coastline of Alaska, but at the same time has definitely become outmoded, too expensive, bigger, older boats, rotting steel, expensive engines, costs are going through the roof in many respects, but the service needs are still there. But this was a discussion back in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and here we are, and we still don't sort of have a a collective approach to figuring this out. And I put that out there maybe to get some input from Captain Falvey or the Deputy Commissioner, because I know the Governor has had an eight-member advisory board. Speaker Stutes was a member of it, as Senator Stedman and others. And so there appears to be a plan going forward, but I'm not convinced it's the plan to actually sort of, you know, fix all this, maybe get it in the right direction. But anyway, am I off base when I say there hasn't been a collective vision? And hopefully, you know, we're close at hand at getting one in terms of reorienting this ship in the right direction.
Mr. Chairman, Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, Representative Edgman, those are great observations, and you're absolutely right. That is a challenge we probably should have had on that slide, is the strengthening of the governance, if you will, of toward Marine Highway. That was a primary recommendation of the working group study as well. It's also the driver behind one of the governor's bills that is introduced, and Representative Stutes has a bill also to have a new revised board replacing the MTAB board. And that board, we're trying to give it a little more teeth, a little more business acumen, and something that can perhaps be somewhat more removed from the political winds, if you will, and to try and give it that guidance, that forward-looking, longer-term and consistent, if you will, guidance. So agree with you 100%, and you know, I'm not blaming anyone in the past. It's obviously a challenge every year on, you know, and there have been plenty of visions for the Marine Highway System, but where we are now, we certainly need to regroup, have a path forward, and we're trying to get there, and I think this new board will be a good step in that direction.
Yeah, Representative Thompson and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to keep going back to it, but I've heard that the closing the bars and the gift shops, that those inventories from the bars and the inventories from the gift shops are still in state possession and in storage, and I was just wondering if that's true or not.
Captain Falvey, through the chair, Representative Olson. No, those inventories are no longer there. They were auctioned off, and they're gone. They were being held in our warehouse, the DOT warehouse in Juneau. So those inventories are no longer there.
Thank you.
Representative.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do we have any further? Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll jump on the on deck on this one. Just a couple nights ago, I met a person out in a local business here in Juneau, someone I hadn't met before, and he told me he was a staffer to the Transportation Committee back in the day when Transportation Committee had its own staffer, and he worked extensively on the railroad and on the ferries as well, and he said the railroad has done really well, partly because they have a lot of assets, a lot of land, and that the ferry does have land and ports and some assets, but it I don't know, apparently doesn't have enough. But back then, as Representative Edgman meant, they've been talking about reorganizing the ferry system more like the railroad. So it doesn't have every time a new administration comes in, they don't change direction. And everyone says that's a great idea. It sort of takes the politics out. You get a bunch of people running it, you know, with long-term vision instead of four-year vision. And I guess, Mr. Carpenter, you alluded to that, and I hope that's still going forward, because the ferry system definitely needs some help, and I haven't been here that long, but I've seen it change a lot in 6 years. And hopefully there is some long-term vision and a way to reorganize the structure so that we don't have to change course every few years with vessel design and you know, route analysis. But and I guess I'll chime in on the bars as well. They're profitable if I rode the ferry in San Francisco Bay from point A to point B. I can't remember exactly. And you get on the ferry, and the very first thing that's there is a bar. And it's very crowded. And I know bar sales and gift shop sales are not going to keep the whole system afloat. I realize that. And I know that short ferry rides are different than long ferry rides. But I hope there's a way to make that work, because anyone in business knows that certain ancillary sales certainly help your bottom line, and gift shops and, you know, hoodies and all that stuff, and high profit margin drinks certainly should be able to pay for the labor that sells them. And if you're paying $110,000 plus benefits to a bartender, those monies might be better used in another way. And hopefully you can get around that obstacle. So I guess those are just my observations. But as far as the long-term reorganization, run it more like the railroad. Do you feel like you have assets other than you know, do you have property and land that you can monetize and do you effectively? And does that help your bottom line?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, a lot of thoughts there, and you know, obviously the I agree with you, the railroad's a little unique in that, well, one, they're off budget, they're kind of out of the Executive Budget Act, and two, they're self-sustaining, they don't really receive any state money anymore, which it contributes a lot to their land and their ability to generate revenue. The Marine Highway System itself doesn't have a land base. Like you said, we have some terminals that are state terminals that we don't generate any money at them. And we have a lot of expensive ships, if you will, which we do generate money. But to your point, you know, I guess the problem with, you know, what is the governance structure that makes the most sense? I think that was a struggle for the working group. They agreed probably that a corporate structure of some sort, like the railroad or something insulated from the legislature, would be maybe the most ideal. However, there are some benefits for sure of Marine Highway being within the Department of Transportation, given the intermodal transportation aspects of it. You know, we not only do Marine Highway System, we have all the road system and all the airports as well, at least the state-owned roads and airports. And being able to have that connectivity and intermodal aspect is definitely a bonus. But you're right, the difference between the railroad and the Marine Highway System is pretty big, and mostly in far as if you did want to make it a corporation or a separate entity, there'd have to be something to where they could sustain or support themselves, or there'd always be a state contribution, if you will, you know, unless we can get this board that has some kind of insulation or some kind of ability to have that longer term multi administration aspects. And that's the goal. So, obviously, a big challenge for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, real quick, because we've got an aging vessels up here, I was curious if you could give an update on what the status of the Malaspina is and where it's headed.
Through the chair, I might have Captain Falvey expand on this, but Representative Carpenter, she is tied up in Ward Cove right now, has been for a while. It's 2019, I believe. We're certainly exploring. We just divested ourselves of the two fast vehicle ferries, and the Malaspina is, I think, next on the list to look at options. We've had some minimal interest in buyers. I say very, very minimal. But we might need to try again, and other options we're considering are scuttling her. We're talking to the EPA on that option of cleaning her up, taking all the asbestos, et cetera, off, and then creating a reef somewhere, or somehow salvaging the steel. There's a lot to explore on that option, but it certainly needs to be something to look at sooner than later, as she costs us money every month, just tied up.
Representative Carpenter?
Thank you. I guess on a quick follow-up on that same subject, then, it sounds like cleaning a vessel of that size before you scuttle it or coming to some regulatory compliance before you do something like that is going to cost a significant amount of money. Do you have an estimation on what that might cost at this time, and would it be better to just hand it over to somebody to for scrap if we have to, if the alternative is paying to clean it before we scuttle it? I guess, and I hear what you're saying. You probably have some more study to do, but can you elaborate a little bit?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think right now we're projecting $500,000 to $1 million to clean her up. And yes, if somebody wanted to make us an offer, we would gladly, instead of cleaning her up, we would gladly sell it. So that's, I think we need to re-explore the sales market. You know, the problem right now is the cruise ship industry. There's endless ships out there for sale. Our fast vehicle ferries were, the market for them was minimal. We were happy to get what we received. And it's challenging to get rid of a ship these days, especially one as old as the Malaspina.
I guess if, and I know that there's probably more options, this is just a brief conversation, but if the option is pay $500,000 to $1 million to scuttle it or find a buyer, is there a middle ground that says instead of paying a bunch of money to scuttle it, could you just hand it off to somebody? Do you have the latitude to just give it away rather than spend $500,000 to $1 million on scuttling it?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's a good question. I believe we could. Maybe Captain Falvey can expand on our the answers to that.
Through the chair, Captain Falvey, Representative Carpenter. To sell the ship to a foreign owner, we need permission from USDOT, and that's a process we'd have to go through to accomplish that.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Carpenter, I believe we are – are we still on slide 2 or slide 3 now?
Through the chair, I believe we're done with slide 2.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving ahead to slide 3. This is, you guys have probably all seen this, one of my favorite slides. Just in brief, I'll run it through here for you. The pink bars on the bottom represent the revenue generated by the Marine Highway System. The dark blue bars on top of them represent the state funding, unrestricted general funds mostly, that went for the system, and together they show the budget for the Marine Highway System back to 1991. These dollars are adjusted for inflation, so they're in 2020 dollars to show, you know, the bigger buying power of older dollars. And then you'll see the squiggly yellow line, which represents our farebox recovery, and that's on the right axis, right vertical axis. You'll see the percentages. And she was, or that line was around 60% and declining in the 90s and 2000s, and then it took a fairly significant drop in the mid-2000s, and you can see the bubble there of the dark blue GF. And then in the later years to where we are now in FY 20 and 21, you can see that they really plummeted, and that was a result of the revenue impacts from COVID. Our revenue has, you know, we've had unrealized revenue to about $45 million level. And then the final bar on the right is the 22 Gov budget, which we're anticipating a return of normal revenue. And with the proposed unrestricted general fund portion would get us back above 50% farebox recovery, which was the intent, I would say, of the last two fiscal years prior to the COVID impact. So I think what this is really showing is, in the earlier years, we were near 50%, nearly a basically a ratio of 50% revenue to state funds. We had a bit of a change in the 2008 to 2019 era, which had a lot of, you know, the fast ferries came online. There was some significant wage increases. There was also huge oil prices and cost drivers that added to that. There was a lot of ports added, port calls added. And those all drove that UGF unrestricted general fund need that much higher. There was also a lot of money the state had at that time. So, you know, the demand or the appetite from the legislature was there to provide that funding. And you can see where we are today, given that, you know, the tight fiscal environment that the state is in for the last few years. Anyway, interesting slide. I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The yellow line is the basis of my question here, and it certainly is a positive projection for an increase in the recovery rate going from 21 to 22. What's the basis for that positive outlook? I mean, I understand perhaps part of it is that some of the COVID things are gonna go away, but is there anything else that would drive that number to as high again to be above 50%? I think it's a good thing if it could happen, but how, I guess what I'm saying is that based on a hope and a prayer, or is there some significant reasons why we think it could go return to that level?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, great question, and I'm going to kick it over to Matt here. You know, I think a lot of it is we're hoping on a return to somewhat normalcy. I know our demand has picked up relative to, you know, last year this time. We are in March, right? Yeah. So last year this time. But Matt can explain a little more about how he got to his projection for FY22 for revenue.
Mr. McLaren, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure. Matt McLaren, business manager for the Ascamarine Highway System. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is a great question. Where this comes from when we were starting to prepare the budget for the governor to review, we looked at the ships we've got available. You know, we started looking at the COVID situation as well, and the direction we were given is to, which is similar to what the legislature has given us the last couple of years, is to shoot for around a 50% recovery. But what we're seeing now with our summer schedule, our summer bookings, we were a little bit late getting the schedule out, but everything we're seeing this coming summer as far as bookings are right in line with a normal fiscal year. The car decks are filling up, especially out of Bellingham and Cross Gulf. There's a lot of military traffic moving from the lower 48 to bases up here in Alaska. So there's been good revenue from that and as they travel. So everything we're seeing now is that this is a safe projection. We're also doing some different things with our schedule, which we'll show in a couple slides later, of how we're covering the state with fewer ships and trying to decrease our costs that way, but still meet the demand that's out there for traffic. But this in itself, we feel, is a safe estimate for revenues.
Okay. Representative Carpenter and then Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. So in regards to the military transfers, what is the dollar figure that we receive for from the federal government on that? And also, I understand there's a designation, scenic highway designation, that we might receive some money from, and any other sources that we receive money from the federal government. What's that total? Or maybe you're going to cover it in another slide, too.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that I don't have that military total in front of me. We can certainly pull that data for the last few years of the number of military bookings and the revenue that's received by that. And then, we'll just have to pull the data. We can answer both those questions for you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this graph, you're showing an increase of recovery from pre-pandemic of around I guess 35% was your number in 2019, which was a high watermark going all the way back to 2012. So even going from 35 to 50%, which is about a 50% increase, how much of that is based on rate increases? Because you don't give sort of vehicle or passenger figures here. You say that it's going to be increased traffic, but that's a lot of increased traffic if the fares stay the same. How much of that is rate increase? And if you do jack up the rates, don't you think that will also put downward pressure on ridership? And how is that calculated in?
Great question. Through the chair, Representative Wold, what we're looking at here with this, it's not as much related to a rate increase. We do see some, if you look at the, I'll say, salmon-colored chart there, 2017 through 2019, you do see some increases in revenues of those fiscal years. That is due to our rate increases, and the next couple slides we'll get into a little bit. We'll show some more detail on the revenue generation, but looking at going to FY22, the 22 governor's proposed budget, the biggest thing that's going to jump up that percentage is not as much the increase in revenues, because 2019, the salmon color there compared to 22 governor's budget is actually a decrease in total revenues. But where we get the biggest percentage increase is due to that blue line that's far lower. Our costs are quite a bit lower in FY22 governor's budget compared to 2019. So our cost recovery percentage, the percentage of our total expenditures we're covering with revenues, is a higher percentage.
Follow up. Thank you. So, and I guess I'll let you get to the next slides, because your recovery is high, but your net sales, what you're saying is not that much higher. Just you're using less budget. You probably have less ships, and maybe overall, I don't know what your ridership's going to do, but I guess I'll just wait. But the percent of cost recovery is not to be confused with increased revenue, I guess is what you're saying.
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, that is correct. If you look at that salmon color back historically in the 90s as well, you know, our revenue has been pretty consistent through all those years, but it's more due to the total expenditures as opposed to the revenue increase. Thank
you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if I missed it, but I was curious what happened, because as you just said, it was pretty stable in the 90s into the, you know, mid to late 2000s, and then it looked like a pretty steep drop between 06 and maybe 08, and then it seemed like we've been sitting in that 30 to 35% recovery rate. So I guess I'm just curious what attributed to almost a decade of 20% lower, roughly, recovery rate, and then all of a sudden spiking back up. Just gives us pause, I think.
Through the chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. Representative Rasmussen, so yeah, interesting, isn't it? You know, 2008-07, that was kind of when oil prices, if you recall, went through the roof. It'd be great if it did that again for our state coffers today. But so a combination of many things that drove that UGF portion, the dark blue bar upwards, one was the high oil prices, in that costs were significantly more as far as fuel. We also had two new vessels that came online, the Fairweather and Chenega, the fast vehicle ferries that just come online roughly. There was added ports of call. There was added operating weeks. Because the state was flush in money, there was a lot more service provided, which caused higher. Essentially, as Matt said, our revenues didn't really increase, but we were incurring more costs, so we needed more state funding, and that made the ratio of the total budget covered by revenue decline from that 50% level down into that 30% level. So, and we're trying to get back to more of that 50% level of revenues to the total state budget and still be able to provide a similar level of service with less ships and utilize more capacity, hopefully, is the goal.
Okay. Mr. Carpenter? Please proceed.
Oh, great. Thank you. Moving on to slide four, I'm going to pass it over to Matt McLaren for revenue further discussion here.
Okay, thanks, Rob. For the record, again, Matt McLaren, business manager for the Marine Highway System. So this slide, we wanted to look at a little more detail for the past 10 years of revenue generation and compared to the blue line, which is the amount of operating weeks our ships ran. So you could equate operating weeks to a level of service, if you will. So as the budgets and total funding has decreased over the years, we've been able to provide fewer and fewer operating weeks from FY13 through FY18, and there was a slight bump up in FY19. But as you can see there, we had a fairly steady level of revenues. We had a drop in FY16, but then FY16 through FY19, we had tariff increases. We implemented dynamic pricing, which helped with our revenue generation in those weeks or those years. Of course, FY20, FY21, the impacts of COVID have greatly diminished our revenue generation. And part of those years, since we use our revenues to operate in the years that we generate them, that of course translated to fewer operating weeks that we could provide in FY20 and then also this year in FY21. But the governor's budget FY22, we are projecting just over $47 million of revenues at 241.9 weeks of service. And if are there any questions on this slide before we move forward?
I don't see any questions. Yep. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McLaren, on this particular slide, it's a little bit different than the previous slide in relationship to the yellow line going up on the previous slide, because that was largely in relationship to less overall GF going to the ferry system. This slide strictly speaks about revenue generated by the Marine Highway System, and it goes from 24 million all the way up to 47 million in revenue. How much is that dependent upon there being very few breakdowns in the system? Because we heard on the first slide about how historically we're seeing more and more breakdowns of the system, aging fleet, and all that. How dependent is reaching that $47 million in revenue dependent on a system that may not be reliable enough to get us that much revenue?
Great question. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that projection there, of course, is based on we're hitting that number of operating weeks. So if we do have breakdowns, if we have shipyard delays, that could definitely have an impact on that revenue number. We try to provide other ways to get that service, but as we've got fewer ships available to operate, we've got less backup service to be able to provide to capture that revenue. So it is completely dependent on being able to run the number of weeks that we plan to run.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The total operating weeks, I'm not sure whether that's good or bad. I don't know. If I had another line up there that showed me what demand was, then I would have an understanding of whether total operating weeks in a decline is a normal thing because decline or a demand is also declining, or whether we're failing to meet demand. I don't understand. Do you have another slide that talks to what your perception of demand was during those time periods and what you're projecting?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, as far as demand, we could provide some utilization, but I think the next slide will get a little bit, provide a little more correlation between operating weeks and the amount of revenue generation. It may answer part of your question, but I'm not sure if it'll answer all of it. So,
Follow up. Thank you. Okay, I'll be happy to wait till the next slide to hear what you have to say. We tend to look at a trend line that says there's a decrease in operating weeks and think, well, we don't want to have that. We want to have an increase or a steady thing, trend of operating weeks. But I don't know whether that is the case or not. Maybe if there's less people wanting to use it, then a decline in operating weeks is something that's okay. And I don't know how to judge that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Carpenter, we do have some ridership charts that we can provide, some historical ridership charts that show where our ridership is in correlation to the number of operating weeks as well. So that may help answer that question about demand and what our ridership levels have been.
Okay, Mr. Carpenter. Or Mr. McLaren.
Okay, continuing on to the next slide. So this slide shows the correlation between the number of operating weeks and our revenue generation. So we're trying to just get a little bit to see how much revenue for each week we operate, each week our ships operate, how much revenue are we generating in that time. So what we want to see is if we're providing more service, does that generate more revenue? Or if we're providing less service, does that just make us more efficient, but we're still able to meet the demand? So what this chart shows from FY11 through FY20, as you can see, there's been a pretty steady increase in the amount of revenue we've been able to generate each week that we operate, with the exception of FY20. Of course, COVID impacted the revenue generation per week, but from FY16 through FY19, we've had steady increase. That's been our dynamic pricing and has helped with the tariff increases to help generate more revenue for each week that we operate. Any questions on this slide?
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe one of the things that you could provide that would help me is within your each one of those years, or I'm not sure how detailed we want to get on this, but what I'm thinking is how many of your sailings, I guess sailings would be the right word here, how many of them are booked up completely, meaning the ship is at max capacity. That would help me understand what our demand is. If you've got a capacity for 100 units and you're only selling 50 of them, then there's an indication of demand. So I'm just kind of trying to understand that.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, that's something we can certainly provide. We do have that data in our annual traffic volume reports, and we'd be happy to provide that information.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps to go a little bit further into this idea of increasing operating weeks, why it may not necessarily equate with increased demand. If we go back to slide three, the one with that one. Let's go back to, you explained how during 2009, 2010, 2011, 12, we had lots of money, so we started putting more UGF into the Marine Highway system, which increased the operating weeks. But with those runs, were some of those runs at least to areas where there was needed service, but not high demand, because that service was to areas where population bases are relatively low in the first place. So while there's a demand for that service to get to Juneau, let's say for a medical appointment or those kinds of things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have an overall increase in demand based on your serving areas where previously you weren't able to serve, but these are unpopulated areas where the overall demand is not going to fill the ship. Is that a safe assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yeah, that'd be a safe assumption. What we saw a lot of that time in, you know, we started operating, as Deputy Commissioner Carpenter said, we started operating the fast ferries. We were running the Chenega around Prince William Sound as well as the Aurora. But looking at our traffic numbers, our traffic was fairly consistent in those years compared to the most recent traffic, even though we were running two ships and more frequency.
I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record. We are at the end of our time, and we've got a number of folks who have a 3:30. So I think what we're going to do is maybe we'll have staff coordinate with Mr. Carpenter and the folks at DOT there and see if maybe we could pick this up back at 1:30 tomorrow during our regularly scheduled meeting. So with that, we'll let folks know. And on top of that, let's see here. I think we've got on tomorrow's agenda, we've got an overview of COVID funding for FY 21 and 22, budget overview, and update by Department of Transportation with Dom Pannone, the Administrative Services Director. So with that, and then like I say, we'll pick up with the rest of this Marine Highway presentation tomorrow. And we will be adjourned at 3:31 p.m. Thank you.